Well, hello, and welcome to the ADA Shop Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Klein, and if you are an ADA coordinator, government official, architect, or accessibility specialist trying to better understand the ADA, then you are in the right place, my friend. The ADA Shop Talk Podcast is brought to you by BlueDag. Check out BlueDag's Transition Plan Builder and Inspection Suite over at BlueDag.com. And yeah, this is the second show this week. Got a great week planned for you. And we're going to talk about demystifying truncated domes, where they go and why they matter here in a minute. But yeah, I hope you're enjoying the show. This is going to be a weekly show in case you're just coming into this. Going to have shows coming out every Wednesday. So look forward to a new show each week, and with announcements and special guests. We got some great guests lining up here at the ADA Shop Talk Podcast, so I hope you can join me each week, and appreciate you tuning in. And also, if you have any questions, send them in to me over at pklein, K-L-E-I-N, at bluedag.com. So send in any questions you have or topic ideas to pklein at bluedag.com, or of course you can join us in the ADA Shop Talk community over at adashoptalk.com. We got a lot of great stuff going in there. Got a great webinar coming up this week, which we'll tell you about here in just a moment. So yeah, let's talk about demystifying truncated domes, where they go and why they matter. And truncated domes are so misapplied, misunderstood. I'm going to take a shot here, put a stake in the sand, and I don't know, kind of have a little history and a little just kind of riff on truncated domes, detectable warnings. You know, do they go on curb ramps? Do they go on site? You know, there's all these different requirements, but they're problematic in a lot of ways because, in my opinion, help so very few, but yet are a barrier to so many. And you'll see this in the code development hearings, especially in California and in the feds, the comments that are, you know, that people get when they're trying to, you know, put these in into the regulations and so forth is, you know, especially people with mobility impairments and batteries and chairs and mobility devices. You know, it's like when we're at the store, you're at Walmart and you roll your cart out and everything falls out of it when they hit those yellow bumps. And, you know, they drive people nuts, and there's all those, you know, and, but yet they're really for the visually impaired and, you know, to help them, you know, have cane detection and some visual, cues to entering a hazardous area or, you know, a vehicle or area and so forth. And so there's kind of been a mismatch of application of this over the years. So I thought we'd go down a little history and you know, I don't know if I have this 100% right, but I just kind of did some digging for this show. And some of you may be total like truncated dome experts out there, and, you know, feel free to chime in, especially in the community, and let me know if I've missed anything or so forth. But the way I kind of look at this, oh, and also this is going to apply all over the United States. So not just California where they're very problematic or other states. I just kind of taken a look at all of the different regulations that they've come in and so forth. And so if we go back in history, you know, pre-current code, and let's go back to the original 1986 ANSI. And in section 4.7.7, they had a section called warning textures. And in this section, it said a curb ramp shall have a detectable warning texture complying with 4.27 and extending the full width and depth of the curb ramp, including any flares, see section 14. So this is way back in the 86 ANSI. And a lot of the codes and regulations at that time with the development of the ADA coming in 91 adopted that ANSI standard. And I know in California, there was language like that, for curb ramps and so forth. The PRORAG wasn't out yet, you know, there. And so some of this was also applicable in federal facilities. And I know there's probably some regulations there in the UFAS. I didn't even look at the UFAS. I should have thought about that. They're be curious to know if they had some stuff in there. I'm sure they did, very similar. And then in the 91 ADA accessibility guidelines, the guidelines from 91, they adopted almost identical language. It said, it was ADA, 1991 ADA AG, America's Disability Act guidelines, section 4.7.7, detectable warnings. And it said, a curb ramp shall have a detectable warning complying with 4.29.2. Detectable warning shall extend the full width and depth of curb ramps. So there you have it, coming in the guidelines. And then with the adoption of the ADA and the standards becoming adopted by the DOJ in 91 also, or 90, and I forget when the, I forget the actual date of the 91 ADAS, somewhere. We know 2010 is March 15th, I think, 2010, and so it was something like that in 91 when the ADAS actually became fully adopted and became the standard, specifically for Title II entities as well as Title III. And it had the same section. So you're seeing a pattern here. And it said, in 4.7.7, detectable warnings, a curb ramp shall have detectable warnings complying with blah, 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 full length and depth. And so that has all been in the those old codes way back in the, starting in the mid 80s and then in the early 90s, coming specifically in the ADAS in 91 and becoming pretty much the standard for nationwide. And so all nationwide, you know, Title II, Title III entities had to follow that standard. Now, since then, the 2010 ADAS sunsetted that. And if you look in the scoping section of the 2010 ADAS, you'll see that all of the detectable warning language for curb ramps and for the areas that it previously was required are all gone. And it specifically only applies to transportation stops and basically transportation, bus stops, light rail, rail crossings and things like that. So, you know, passenger transportation facilities, essentially. So it basically sunsetted with the adoption of the 2010 ADAS. But what happened is because a lot of state codes like California, you know, Illinois and Oregon and New York and a lot of others had developed their state codes based on that old federal standard, a lot of the state codes still had have that language in there. So the one state that does have it still, I believe, actually, no, it's sunsetted too. So the Illinois Accessibility Code had it as all the way up until the 97, Illinois Accessibility Code. It was 400.31D7. And it required the same kind of language, curb ramps, full length and depth, and you know they had language in there for truncated domes as well. But then they adopted in 2000. Oh, when was it? It was the, I think it was 2000. It was the basically they moved to the 2010 ADS as their model code. So and what from what I can tell, they sunsetted that requirement as well. So I believe the current Illinois code doesn't have truncated domes, just like, the ADAS. Now, moving on to the next one would be Oregon. Oregon did have same thing. It was back in 2010. The Oregon State Specialty Code is what it's called, Section 1103.2.3, had the same thing: curb ramps shall have detective warnings, full length and depth, blah blah blah, including the side flares, which makes no sense, but at any rate, I hate when you put them on the side flares because it's just such a tripping hazard. But anyway, it was like that in the 2010 Oregon Specialty Code. I don't believe it's in the current one. I need to double check that. But clearly it had the old language in there, and so what's confused everything is with the adoption of the ADAS, it sunsetted that specifically for Title III entities for sure, but it still has it for transportation facilities. In California, the truncated domes, full length and depth for truncated or for curb ramps has been around forever. We had this hazardous vehicular area deal. It went all the way back to the 92 CBC. It was the old 3106.D7. It was also an 1127B and 1117A, which was the old 11A, but all the way back to the 92 CBC to and the current CBC, although the current CBC in 2010 and 13 specifically, they adopted and transitioned their state code to the match the ADAS with all their California adoption, but they kept a lot of the truncated dome language, the hazardous vehicular areas and things like that. And then more recently in the 19 and the more recent 2022, they totally revamped it. And it's a can of worms, but it basically is a, they have circulation paths and I don't know, I've got mixed feelings on it. I think they've done more harm than good in my opinion. And anytime you need, you know, six or seven exceptions to a code section, to make sense of a code section, it's bad code. so that, you know, that basically they required a circulation paths and all this new language in there. And it's just caused a lot of issues, in California. So anyway, so in California, obviously you've had the truncated dome requirements from 92 all the way to today, but, in a nutshell, for the rest of you that are just basically with the ADAS, and let me bring that up really quick. So yeah, in the 2010 ADAS for private, you know, public accommodations, it's in 218 transportation facilities where it's scoped, and new and altered stations and rapid rail, light rail, commuter rail, intra-city rail, high-speed rail, and other fixed guideway systems shall comply with 810.5 and track crossings. That's where you'll find truncated dome requirements and so forth. Some bus shelters. So essentially in transportation facilities is the only place that it's scoped in the 2010 ADAS, and there's no there's nothing in curb ramps. There's no nexus there. So from the DOJ Title III 2010 ADAS perspective, there's nothing required for that. Now, if you go to the ABA, and it's consistent with the 2010 ADAS, I thought there was a difference with curb ramps under the ABA. So there isn't. Where it was, it's in the PROAG. So in the PROAG, in section R208, it talks about detectable warning services for curb ramps. So you're talking about public right-of-way, signalized intersections and so forth. So there's a PROAG requirement, and with the new adoption coming pretty soon, I don't recall if that's been revised or omitted out of there, but at any rate, you have, you know, you could have some different requirements depending on your project, you know. So a private within the site Title III entity, you know, Starbucks or a Target or something like that, just straight ADAS, you're good. No truncated domes are required. And even for a Title II entity within the site, say they're doing a new police station or a new courthouse or something like that, and they're building curb ramps and everything within the site, technically no truncated domes. However, if it is part of the public right-of-way and they're following the PROAG, the 2010-11 PROAG, there are truncated dome requirements on curb ramps and so forth there. So there's no easy answer when it comes to truncated domes, but you can kind of see the history there. And then you've got the state, you know, requirements, but from what I can tell, the primary states that you're going to, you know, need to be aware of if you're working in multiple states like I do is, you know, California, Oregon, Illinois, and I believe that's most of them from my research. There may be some more, but you know, you'd want to double check. And then for Title II entities and Title III entities, you're good, except if you're applying the PROAG or you're in a public right-of-way condition where you're applying the right-of-way guidelines, then you're going to have some truncated dome requirements. So that's kind of the quickie overview of it. I know we could go, a lot deeper into like the sizes and all that kind of. It's kind of hard to do on a podcast because I can't show you the code sections, but you can look up all those technical requirements in the ADAS. And there's a lot of foundations out there for the blind and advocacy groups that have more information on that. You can look at more of the whys and who they help and how they help. And the problem, in my opinion, is they've been, misapplied. And again, they can be a barrier to many more than they actually help. So they can be problematic. So, we just advocate that you use them judiciously, is that the word? Or, diligently and in the right application, in the right, scenario and so forth, and not over apply them. My experience has been architects and designers, think a little bit is good, so more must be better. And so they start sticking them everywhere, and then they just confuse people who they're supposed to help, and then they become a barrier for everybody else. And so that's one of the big problems with them and everything. But little history there, that's how all this accessibility regulations and standards and codes kind of evolves, I don't know if I've said this before. I know I have in my classes, if you look at the development of accessibility codes compared to other codes, look at the fire codes and the exiting codes and even the electrical and plumbing codes. The first life safety codes came out in the US in like 1922. Okay. And so there was a long time of code development and unfortunately disasters, fires and death that helped those codes evolve. And the first accessibility codes didn't really come out till the 60s. So that's, it's almost 40 years of advanced code development before we even got to the 60s, from the 20s to the 60s. So the fire life safety codes and plumbing codes all had a lot of time to vet themselves out. Disability codes and really only applied to the feds for a long time. And it didn't even come into the private sector under Title III till the 90s. And so if you think about that, that's from the 20s, that's 70 years before it came into the 90s. And then it's been with us for just about 30 years. So my point is that it takes time for these codes to be refined and improved. And, the feds don't operate on a 3-year cycle like they do in some states, or even in the ANSI process, it's more frequent. But we've only had one significant revision to the ADAS in since 1990, and that was in 2010. And so it just takes time. And unfortunately, to be an accessibility specialist and understand and apply this stuff, you've kind of got to know those differences. And you just can't look up the height of a grab bar and call it good on some of this stuff. There's gray area, nuance, and so forth. And if you're an architect or an owner, and sometimes it's a best practice to provide more access or go above and beyond minimum code. And so those are those things. Maybe you have a development that's designed and marketing towards people with disabilities. So maybe you want to have a little more mobility units or a little more accessible features in your design because it's going to provide services and facilities for that segment. And so that's another consideration and so forth. But anyway, that's my truncated dome kind of quickie overview, little history, and hope I demystified some of it or help you understand why it's as complex as it is and it's not as easy. Fortunately, the 2010, it's pretty straightforward and so forth. But, just be aware if you have a PROAG project or a state that I mentioned previously that may have some requirements you want to check. So anyway, that's the show for today. Thank you so much for joining me. I just want you to keep in mind and consider joining me in the free ADA Shop Talk community over at adashoptalk.com. And of course, you can email me any questions or suggestions you have for the show at pkline@bluedag.com. And also this month's webinar, which is actually going to be tomorrow, tomorrow, February 22nd, 2024, Ensuring Accessibility in Transient Lodging, a guide to the 2010 ADAS. That's going to be from 11 o'clock to noon Pacific time. And it'll be myself and Victor Felix, who's also a CASP. It's free, and you can get some CEUs. And again, you can go over to adashoptalk.com and register for that. I'd love to have you join us. We'll have some Q&A. Got a great presentation prepared for you. So we'll dive into transient lodging and kind of breaking down all the requirements for hotels and motels and those kinds of things. If you haven't already subscribed to the ADA Shop Talk podcast, please subscribe on your favorite player, such as iTunes, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. And hey, go out there and rock your ADA efforts. Remember, let's all work together to create a world where everyone has the opportunity to thrive. My name is Paul Klein. Thank you so much for joining me. Take care, and until next week, we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.